excitement going on. Actually, there aren't very many people for that. The weather killed Przanski's dog and pony show.
It did it? Okay, are we ready? All right. Good morning. It's 8 o'clock. The House Committee on Revenue will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4106. Who's presenting?
Anyone?
Chris, is that your bill?
No.
Who's missing?
Christine.
Okay. Tell. There she comes. Christine, you're on. And Representative Gomberg and Representative Widener? I saw Representative Gomberg a second ago, so.
He did it the other direction.
Yeah. Just for future reference, at least for the next week, this committee is quite busy, and we will be planning to start public hearings on time. Yeah. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4106 would clarify that the stores and cafes and cafeterias of tax-exempt museums, where the rest of the building receives a tax exemption under the charitable literary and scientific organizations exemption, would also be exempt. There has been some different methods of assessing that in recently, and so this would address that. This would apply to property tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2014.
Wonderful. Representative Gomberg, good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're
in public hearing on House Bill 4106.
No, I understand, and I had understood, for the record, David Gomberg, House District 10 on the Central Coast. I understood Representative Widener is going to be here to present here, and I was just going to share a little background to...
Well, that's what I understood, and I also understood that somebody needed to be in committee at 8:30, so we try to accommodate.
Well, if it pleases the committee, I know that Kevin Mannix is here, who has an interest in this bill, and perhaps he can present an overview.
We'd be very happy to hear from former Representative Mannix.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Mannix. I'm a Salem attorney, and yes, I'm pleased to have been a former member of this institution. I'm here today. I plan to be here today to assist Representative Widener, but I'm happy to pinch hit and work with my former neighbor.
Well, in fairness, Representative Widener, we have to note that the weather this morning is particularly bad, and there are some committee members who are going to be late because of that. So that doesn't surprise me much. Please go ahead.
House Bill 4106 is intended to codify what has been long-standing interpretation of Oregon law in regard to the application of property taxes to nonprofit museums. It specifically is directed towards museums of history, science, and natural science. If you take a look at the statutes and the case law and the application over many years in Oregon, it has been understood that a nonprofit museum of this nature could carry on its operations and its facilities would be exempt from property taxation. Recently, there has been a movement to start attempting to tax museum stores or museum coffee shops or snack bars in one county. This bill is designed to clarify what was understood to be the existing law for many years and to codify it so that it will be clear for the future that the 246 nonprofit museums that we've been able to identify, which exist throughout the state, will be able to maintain the practice that they've had in the past. This bill does not allow an exemption for any commercial enterprise or for any enterprise that is not operated within a museum. It's your usual museum store, museum coffee shop, or museum theater where they're showing films and making presentations about their educational function. There is some language in this bill that talks about rehabilitation and other issues. I'm advised by legislative counsel that that was put in simply as other legislation which had already passed, and they're simply clarifying some language. And that threw me off when I saw that in the bill, but I'm told that that has no substantive effect. It's simply a clarification from other legislation which has passed. What this bill is about the museums and the property tax exemption, which I mentioned.
Very good. Representative Widener?
Thank you, Chair Barnhart.
distinguished members of the committee. My name is State Representative Jim Widener, House District 24, and I thank you for your time and consideration in hearing House Bill 4106 today. This is a simple bill, as Kevin has explained to you. This bill has many co-sponsors, and the co-sponsors have considered this bill to be named as Oregon's Museum Protection Act. Oregon is home to over 250 education and nonprofit museums. In fact, amongst the members on this committee right here, 30 museums in our state are represented by you. Those 30 museums rely upon the supplemental income derived from their gift shops, educational and recreational films, and on-site cafes. These funding mechanisms assist the overall budget of these nonprofits and are staffed by museum workers and volunteers. Without such supplemental income, Oregon's museums are in danger of being shut down to the degradation of our society and the state culture. These halls of history and science help educate Oregon students, youth, and enthusiasts, and are considered indispensable by many Oregonians. Unfortunately, there has been a situation, as you've just heard, unprecedented in Oregon museum operational history, where a county assessor in my county of Yamhill was in search of new revenue and sought to tax a supplemental income cafe operated in our Space Aviation Museum by attempting to rezone the cafe as commercial property, subject to commercial real estate property taxes. This bill seeks to clarify and codify the proper interpretation as agreed upon by 35 other counties in Oregon. This unprecedented divergence from the traditional viewpoint threatens to spread across the state, and if remained unchecked, can place an undue burden upon museums that will in turn drive up entrance fees and reduce community and educational involvement, leading to closures of our museums. To address some concerns, I want to be clear. This bill clearly excludes any commercial enterprise operating on any 501c3 museum property. So the cafe staffed by museum workers and volunteers cannot become a Starbucks. Furthermore, there is no revenue impact upon the counties because no other county has ever interpreted the law to allow such taxation. In closing, I would like to paraphrase America's favorite archaeologist, Henry Indiana Jones, Jr. Unlike Marcus, let us not get lost in our own museum. This is a simple bill, let's not get lost in which portion of the museum is commercial taxable property and which is zoned as a 501c3 nonprofit. I appreciate your time, consideration of this bill, and I hope we can move forward with this in a speedy manner. Thank you.
And thank you again, Mr. Chairman. And once again, for the record, David Gomberg, House District 10 on the Oregon coast. You've heard a little testimony today about the Space and Aviation Museum. I came today to serve as Representative Widener's wingman. And I did that for a couple of simple reasons. Those reasons not only include the Evergreen Museum, which is a few miles from my district, but the Tillamook Air Museum, which is in my district, the Oregon Coast Aquarium, which is in my district. And, you know, most of these operations subsist on very thin margins. And the enterprises that we're talking about here play a very important role in their ability to continue operating. Now, I want to make it very clear that I am not enthused about tax-subsidized organizations competing with the private sector. But I see this as an exception to that kind of concern because these enterprises, which often exist in rural and tourist regions, are magnets. They're magnets that bring more people to the area and create more jobs across the board. And I think that's a significant aspect of what we're talking about here. If we can keep operations like this open, then we're going to create more jobs. And that's why I signed on to this bill and wanted to come here and just testify very briefly about it.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? I will note that there may be different, there may be in somebody, but I don't see anyone else signed up in favor of this bill. So I think if we have any questions about it, we need to ask this panel. Yes, Representative Berger.
Yes, and they may not be able to answer this, and there may be more expert testimony on this, but as
someone who frequents these kinds of things with my grandkids and pays pretty penny in those gift stores, and and the food is too expensive. That's just my editorial comment. The question, but I understand why, and I pay it, okay, because I do support the organization by going there. So are these organizations, a lot of them, and I know this was precipitated by a single organization, but it has huge implications across the state for a lot of different, you know, how we land on this could affect a lot of different organizations. Do they generally, like their restaurants, do they run it themselves, or do they hire a company that then would pay profit on their contract? And you understand the distinction?
I do. You want me, Kevin, or you want?
And or do they do both? And what are the impacts?
These are covered in statute, but I'll let Kevin.
Representative Berger, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. In regard to your question, the dynamics are simple here. Almost all of these museums operate their food service facilities or whatever facilities on their own with their own staff or volunteers. This bill specifically exempts any commercial operation, as Representative Wiedner mentioned. As I was working on this project to assist Representative Wiedner, I've been in communication with museums throughout the state. And you may be hearing testimony later that, oh, the Department of Revenue now discerns that this is a change in the law. I challenge the opponents of this bill to name one museum outside of Yamhill County which is currently taxed as to a snack bar or a coffee shop or as to their theater where they may show educational films. The reality is presently, having talked to the High Desert Museum, having talked to OMSI, having talked to the Oregon Historical Society, which doesn't have food services but has a store, none of them are presently subjected to property taxation as to those operations, so long as they are run by the museum, they're within the museum, they're done in conjunction with museum operations. And there may be one or two places somewhere in the state where there is a commercial enterprise leasing space. That is not covered by this bill. It's purely about the museum operations themselves.
Thank you. That's what I want to clarify, that if it is a commercial operation,
it is taxable.
It is taxable. But we're talking specifically here, excuse me, Mr. Chair, I wanted to get this on the record clearly, operations by the museum, and yes, they want to enhance their facility and not lose money on these operations. I understand that, and so I'm not really complaining about the price, except those really expensive gewgaws that my grandkids always want that they could only get at that museum,
which help keep the doors open.
That which help keep the doors open. I'm really not complaining.
Other questions? I have several, and what I'm trying to do is, as I ask questions, is to try to figure out how to distinguish these non-commercial enterprises that sell things in what you say here in conjunction with public displays at the museum to educate the public about history or science and to sell or hold out for sale goods related to the displays or educational purpose of the museum or goods and services providing refreshment to the public while visiting the museum. Those are the things that you're asking to be carved out from the normal rule, which is if it's for sale and you make some money at it, then it's taxable. I mean, that's the normal rule even for a nonprofit.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, please.
Actually, there's two different concepts at work here. There is
go ahead and explain that to us.
There is the income tax concept, which has to do with unrelated business income.
Yes.
And that we'll look to IRS standards. And there still may be unrelated business income in some of these operations that would be taxable.
By the state of Oregon as income tax.
As income tax. And that is a separate standard. Then there is the property tax standard, which is whether or not the facility is being used as part of the museum operation. And the court decisions have said that you can have a small amount of what I'll call non-related activity, but that the majority of the activity for a charitable institution and a scientific institution needs to be related to the purpose of the institution. And the example I would use would be, for instance, a museum store, which largely sells books and films about and T-shirts about the museum and about the object of the enterprise, but then may have some trinkets for sale, some souvenirs that are questioned, you know, that are not really clearly related to what is going on in the institution, toys for the kids. But on the other hand, you may also have educational toys or models that fit in with that, the purpose of the museum. And what you do is you look at the enterprise and make sure that the vast majority of what is being sold there is related to what the museum is about. There may still be some trinkets or and that sort of thing that are more souvenirs that don't have any direct relationship. If it's a small part of the sales, it doesn't matter. But for the feds and for the income tax purposes, that may matter. It may be considered unrelated business income and has to be coded that way.
Thank you. That's helpful. I refer you to the paragraph ahead. One of the nice things about the our drafting rules is that we look at the whole statute. And in the paragraph ahead of the one that you're asking for, what's called F, that line 25 through 28 on whatever page that is, the real and personal property of an art museum that's used in conjunction with public displays of works of art or used in, to educate the public about art would presumably be exempt, but not including any portion of the art museum's real or personal property that's used to sell or hold out for sale works of art, reproductions of works of art, or other items to be sold to the public. I'm having a difficulty, and you probably know, and I don't know, what the distinction is, why it is that an art museum should have to pay for property taxes on property that's used to sell other items to be sold to the public. But a history museum, natural history museum, or science museum should not be required to pay property taxes on that property. Go ahead and
May I, Mr. Chairman?
Please, go ahead.
And members of the committee, that is the result of a special bill that was passed at the request of art dealers and art museums because there was a real question as to an art museum having price tags on all of the pieces of art throughout the entire museum as to whether or not, how do they, is that an art dealer or is that an art museum? And the compromise that was passed by the legislature in recent years was a specific provision for art museums that said it's okay to have your museum and everything on display. If you're selling something, you've got to have a separate little shop for the sales, and that shop will be, because it's analogous to an art dealer shop, will be taxable. So it was a specific area of concern where the intrinsic object itself was being sold as an art object. In this case, museums, historic science museums, are usually not presenting objects for sale within the museum, and the store may have a model of an aircraft, or it may have a book by a given author about a subject. So that's the distinction that I would make here. There is a specific problem and issue for art museums versus art dealers.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Tell us what the distinction is between other items to be sold to the public, which, of course, might be a refreshment area or a restaurant at the art museum, and your request for goods or services providing refreshment to the public while visiting a museum. Why are those different in an art museum than in one of the museums you're asking about?
If I may?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the distinction would be in a natural science museum or a history museum or science museum, what you see on display is not for sale.
Mm-hmm.
They may be loaned objects. They are being presented for the public to learn from and enjoy. And then when you go to the shop, you may get a model or a book or a video about what's going on in aviation.
Or a Coca-Cola.
I'll deal a little separately, if I may, with
Please,
the food service
ahead.
Question. Yeah. But when you're going to that shop, you're not buying the aircraft or the telescope or the other device that was in the museum. You're buying a book about it, and they're trying to extend the education program. And the tension for the art museums was there are art dealers, commercial art dealers, who have galleries who are selling paintings, and their question was, why are these museums allowed to sell things that are on display competing with us? We don't have that same issue here as to those materials. As to food services, the distinction is usually made that you've got a place that's serving the patrons of the museum, mm-hmm. and it's operated within the museum hours by the museum for the patrons and the staff. I don't think that the art museum legislation was intended to deal with food services specifically. I think it was really intended to deal with the sale of art.
Okay, so you don't know whether any art museums have food service, and if they do, whether or not they pay property tax on the portion of the museum that's used for that purpose.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, I won't say that I know. I believe that that is correct, that actually there are art museums that have cafes and food service facilities, and since they're not selling works of art there, those food services facilities would be tax exempt.
Okay, even though it says, or other items to be sold to the public. I mean, just reading the plain language, it would seem pretty clear that a restaurant would be taxable in an art museum.
And I can't answer that directly. I would have to say, though, that my understanding would be that that doesn't relate to the food services.
Great. Thank you very much. Other questions? Have I triggered anything? All right. Thank you. Oh, yes, please.
If I may, in closing.
Yep. Representative Widener, and then Representative Berger, do you want to go first?
Yeah.
And then let him close?
I think that we may have opened a significant can of worms. I frequent the YMCA, which is a nonprofit across the street, and for a while they had a little deli in there.
Yeah.
Did they pay property taxes on that little deli in there?
I have no idea.
So the broadness of the possibilities here when you start talking about restaurants and nonprofits, it begs the question that I think we really need to clarify this in some way for the sake of not just history museums, but on the food piece, because this could have implications way beyond history museums to all kinds of. I mean, there's the income tax if you have someone doing that service for you, but what about the property taxes? And Mr. Chair, I think this is a kind of a really important piece.
Well, and let me add to that point. It's possible that there's a distinction that I simply don't understand yet. About the way a shop like this is operated. I think one of the comments that one of you made early on had to do with volunteers helping to run these kind of facilities. It's possible that there might be a reasonable distinction to be made between a 7-Eleven or a gas station restaurant across the street from the museum, which is a for-profit business and pays property taxes, versus the shop in the museum run by volunteers. I mean, I can imagine that kind of distinction. It's hard for me to imagine, frankly, a distinction between an operation which is run like a commercial enterprise, even though it's not separately incorporated and not separately managed as a for-profit business by the museum, in the museum on the one hand, and the shop across the street. That distinction by itself is difficult for me, and this language, I think, covers exactly that possibility as I follow it. I don't know whether you want to comment on that observation or not, but I'd be interested if you do.
If I may, but I should defer to the representatives first.
Well, I think you're catching what we're after. Because the big thing because I don't want to dig into this too heavily, but the big thing we're trying to do here is protect the history of Oregon and the country and have these museums left alone in place, because we're trying to tax the property. And if you can imagine, I mean, we're looking at a very large piece of land where the Spruce Goose sits just to house that in an aviation space museum. And if we say, hey, if you have a coffee shop there or something like this in that facility, well, they can't sell popcorn. They can't do things like that when they're having these events that help keep the place open. And you're going to see museums start to shut down over time, and we won't have any of these treasures in our state. And they're huge tourist attractions that bring people to the coast. They stop there at the Space Museum, then they go down and buy a kite. Which is very good for our representatives.
So that raises another question for me. Are you saying that the land, that the space, the warehouse or whatever it is that where the Spruce Goose is parked, is being added to the property tax rolls, that space, or simply the space where where refreshments are being sold. I mean, which is a small, one presumes a much smaller space.
It's a smaller space, but when you look at the building that's put in place, now all of that comes into play in that smaller space. So I imagine the property tax, I mean, you could value that very highly and be looking at a large property tax bill on that small space.
Great.
And Kevin, if you
Any closing remarks, and then we need to go on to our next panel.
If I may, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the food service issue has actually been directly addressed by the Oregon Supreme Court in the 1960s. There was a Portland YMCA that had a coffee shop, and the assessor sought to tax the coffee shop, and the Supreme Court said, wait a minute, the coffee shop is there to provide for the patrons of the YMCA and for the residents and for the volunteers and staff. That they're not there to really reach out to the rest of the world, although perhaps somebody could come in and make use of it, and it is exempt under the existing statutes. They simply looked at the use of the facility and whether it was there to serve the purpose of the institution. And the way we have tried to define food services here is they're there to serve the purposes of the institution within the facility for the patrons. And if, since the Evergreen Museum came up as an example, there is a McDonald's 1.4 miles away from the Evergreen Aviation and Space Museum. But do you think a family is going to pack up the kids, put them in the van, drive a mile and a half off campus to go somewhere to grab a snack or a bite to eat and then drive all the way back and bring the kids back in? Usually, museums are expected to have restrooms, some kind of food service facility, especially if you're on a campus where you're moving around, and a place where after the museum experience you pause to pick up something that relates to the experience, that extends that experience for you. That is what we're talking about here. The Oregon Historical Society has a museum store, but it's about history and it's about everything that they do. They're located in an area where there are nearby food service facilities, so they don't have a food service facility. You walk out the door, walk a half a block, and you can have lunch. And that's how they explained it to me. They didn't see a need for it for their patrons. So the dynamic is this legislation would continue to empower facilities to do within their facility, nonprofits, what they've always done. And again, I say, I challenge the opponents to name one museum outside of Yamhill County that has been subjected in the past to a property tax for these operations. I couldn't find one checking around the state, and we're simply trying to lock that in to maintain that, not to do something new.
Great. Appreciate that. Could you get the citation to the case you referred to us? That would be helpful, I think. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'll just reiterate very quickly, these institutions are cultural assets to the state of Oregon, but they're economic assets to the small communities where they reside. We need to do all we can to protect and preserve them.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We have Gil Rydell, Bob Vroman, and Jeff Ivey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're pleased to join in this interesting conversation. For the record, Gil Rydell, Association of Oregon Counties. I'm accompanied by Bob Vroman, who's the Clackamas County Assessor and Tax Collector, and Jeff Ivey, who's a Deputy Assessor of Yamhill County, who is very familiar with the nine cases that are directly subject to this bill, and he's here to provide any expert testimony and answer questions you may have about the particular fact situation we're talking about. I will move quickly because I've submitted my comments electronically, but I want to state that I list both specific reasons related to the bill and general reasons related to property tax expenditures to urge you not to pass this bill. This bill amends a property tax exemption statute that is difficult to interpret, and I believe Chair Barnhart discovered that
I illustrated
this morning,
that, didn't I? Yes.
In its current form by broadening the exemption with more vague language that will result in even more litigation. And I hasten to add, if museums are exempt under the current statute,
can you ask?
And Evergreen,
Mr. Chair,
just a moment.
I cannot find Mr. Riddell's submission on OLAS. Is it me or is it?
I've come up with it.
I left some hard copies.
That seems like a normal thing.
That happened yesterday.
It did happen yesterday. My computer seems to be set up differently than yours, Representative Berger.
I'm sorry, Gil.
Because you have a gavel right next to you.
Maybe that's it. This is the signaling device.
I'm not the only one. Meeting material, 4106.
And nothing comes up.
That's what comes up.
The preliminary SMS, but that's it.
Preliminary SMS is all I'm getting.
I brought hard copies, just in case.
Okay, thank you.
Yours is coming.
None of that is coming.
My screen looks completely different from yours. I wonder if you're on a different page.
Well, measure details. I'm looking at meeting materials and exhibits. There. No, preliminary SMS. That's all we have.
Yes, a hard copy.
Thank you. Hard copy's fine. Thank you, Gal. I'm sorry, but...
I've got it. Thanks.
Thank you.
You don't have it either. Oh, yes, you do. Yes, we're still learning about our technology. We're trying to go paperless. We'll get there someday.
I apologize for interrupting, but I did want to see what you were looking at.
Good, thank you.
Now, if there were property tax on every piece of paper, we'd get this done faster. Thanks.
Well, Mr. Chair, I hasten to add to the written remarks that if other museums are exempt under the current statute, and Evergreen should be, why change the statute? I think what we see here is the facts are prominent in Yamhill County's denial. It indicates there are some factual issues, so why not let the court make its ruling on the Yamhill facts rather than preempt or negate what is now in the judicial process in 9 instances. And then we can talk about what needs to be changed and try to fix this on a comprehensive way rather than property by property. But I point out 4 examples of added vagueness that does not help clarify this statute that the proponents wish to add to the already vague statute. They want to add open land, not in agricultural use. There's no limit on the acreage of that land. They want to add an exemption for property used in conjunction with public displays. Does this include a water park, I wonder? They want to grant an exemption for goods and services providing refreshment to the public. What about catering private events? These are all factual issues. And it also would grant an exemption to property used as a theater for presentations about history or science. How frequently must the theater be used for that purpose? And what if the theater is used for other purposes? But what this bill does, it negates any non-final judicial rulings on appeals beginning on or after July 1, 2011. These are 9 denials by Yamhill County with the backing of Department of Revenue based on the facts there of exemptions of the Evergreen Museum. What we have at both the tax court level and magistrate level are disputes amounting to $400,000 of taxes for public services. I consider the moral most relevant to this bill is legislation that is property specific rarely is good public policy. And this is property specific, yet still vague. I list other more general reasons why you need to heighten your scrutiny about this exemption, any new language in property tax exemptions. The property tax system has been cut, capped, and limited already to the benefit of the property owner. New exemptions are straight losses of funds to education and public services. And the timing is wrong. We're in a period, at least in county government, where we're slashing local budgets and we don't have enough for county sheriff's patrols. And remember, statewide, education gets 44% of the property taxes. And I would cite 2 studies, the Governor's Task Force on Federal Force Payments and County Services, which observe that local governments bear the brunt of revenue losses when the state enacts new property tax breaks. And the Task Force on Comprehensive Revenue Restructuring, which was created by legislation in 2007, made up of 30 members, including Co-Chair Barnhart and Representative Reed, and they recommended that the legislature needs to refrain from new property tax expenditures. We think this is a new property tax expenditure. The issue is about the facts, and we're prepared to discuss both the policy as you go forward and the facts of this case. So, with that, I'd have Bob Roman make comments, if you wish, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And other members of the committee may have other issues, but I'd be extremely interested in understanding what the general rule is that you expect to enforce in dealing with these kinds of museums, and what the specific issue is here, if it's different from that, that led to the assessment. And so the two of you, I suspect, know that, have that information. And I, just a parenthetical comment, aren't you really pleased that you're, that you have this particular role and that you get to spend every day with us for a while?
Well, actually, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Bob Vroman. I'm the Clackamas County Assessor, but I'm here on today on behalf of the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. And I do thank you for the opportunity to come back and see you again today. I don't want you to get the impression that assessors are against every exemption that has ever been thought of, because that's not the case. We are, however, opposed to this particular bill because, as it's been stated, it appears to broaden an exemption, but yet provide little clarity to how that's going to be implemented and administered. And it's an already complicated statute. This particular bill proposes to change 307-130, which is a major exemption statute dealing with a charitable and benevolent scientific types of institutions. And very honestly, these are very important activities, not only to the state, but to the people that do them. And so there has never really been a simple bill, I don't think, about exemptions. And I think that it's important that that there be clarity with these types of bills, so that you know, we're able to carry out your administrative and social and economic goals that deal with exemptions, which are exceptions to property taxation in this state. When they're vague, what happens is that we end up with eligibility battles, which is kind of what we're talking about today, even if it's only on a portion of a property, and long and costly litigation sometimes. And administration by litigation is not an effective way to administer our system. Necessary sometime, but not usually a cost-effective way in general. So, you know, we're concerned about this bill because we think there are areas that are vague with a statute that already is somewhat vague. And I appreciate the comments earlier that these things really need to be clarified. We agree with Representative Berger and you, Chair Barnhart, that these things need to be clear so that not only the people that engage in these activities understand the requirements for qualification, the scope on which an exemption would apply, lost opportunity costs when revenue is foregone, and certainly the benefits that they provide. And we're certainly willing to support that thoughtful and thorough consideration of how these should be structured to accomplish that. And we don't think that can happen in this short session. So we're more than willing to look at how we can make this better, but I think it needs to be given the appropriate time to actually be able to do that. And I'll be happy to try to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Good morning, Representative Barnhart and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Ivey, and I'm the Deputy Assessor for Yamhill County. And this bill would directly affect our county. We currently have 9 cases in various stages of trial. Some have already been heard by Judge Breithaupt in the tax court. Some are pending trial. Some are pending in magistrate as well, or in abeyance pending the outcomes of higher-up decisions. So I would just be willing to answer any questions that you might have specifically related to those cases, but our position is that we would be opposed to the amendments as listed in this bill as well.
Let me give you a topic then.
Sure.
Because I think that the point that Gil has raised is an important one. I think what he's saying is that the issues here are fact-based and they're related to the specific issues involving these specific facilities. It would be, I think, helpful for us to understand how this assessment process, or how the facts that are related to this assessment process that you're engaged in, are different from what they would be with other museums or other facilities that superficially look similar.
Sure.
I mean, he referred to that, and I think that would be extremely helpful for us to understand.
Okay. Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, with respect to that, some of the facts in this case are that the museum itself is exempt. As you heard earlier this morning, it's a small area within the museum, the cafe, and there's a wine shop and also a gift shop in each of the museum complexes. There's two large buildings, and each one has a cafe area and a gift shop that sell. You heard Mr. Mannix discuss about trinkets and other items within the gift shop. Well, in 2011, if I can give you a little background.
Please, that's what I asked for.
Yeah. When we did an inspection of the property for a property tax exemption because of an application that came in, we noticed that there were multiple items in the gift shop, for instance, that were logoed with the Evergreen for-profit enterprise being sold in the gift shop, not your typical Evergreen Museum t-shirts or the like, but actual the for-profit company that there's Evergreen International Airlines and some other corporations that are under that umbrella were being sold in the gift shop, had nothing to do with the items on display, so to speak, in the museum. There's a great deal of catering for private events that goes on out of the cafes that are in the various gift shops or in the various museums. So there's private events that are held after hours. The for-profit company would pay to rent the theater that you heard discussed a little bit earlier for their corporate meetings and presentations for corporate-based type of ideas. So the facts are, you know, that is there a percentage of time that needs to be used by the organization for nonprofit use versus for-profit use? You know, that's not specified in the statute, and that's one of the, you know, facts that are contested before the court right now.
When you say statute, you mean the bill?
Yes.
Yeah.
And current statute, the way it's currently
written.
Yes.
Written.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So if this bill were approved, what effect would it have, if any, on the litigation?
It would negate it.
It would negate it.
Okay. Go ahead.
Representative Berger? Yeah. I'm really interested in your comments about this muddies the water. Actually, what we're attempting to do here is clarify the water. And we do that all the time when facts become disputed and they are brought down here for clarification. So I'm a little resentful of your implication that we're muddling or we're muttering this up when actually we're trying to bring clarity to this statute. And it is because we care deeply, at least I do, about these museums that are not just one in your county, but throughout. And the implications for what's going on here, I mean, I was asked, why are you a sponsor of this? Because I care deeply. When I walk into the High Desert Museum, I bring my kids. They buy food. I have been in nonprofit art museums to catered events after hours and been served wine and food, and I never asked, are we paying property taxes as I'm sitting here enjoying a luncheon at the Portland Art Museum? That wasn't a question that came into my mind as I sat there. So the fact that the Evergreen Museum may have catered events doesn't impress me as a reason. Okay, so what I guess I'm looking for here is, if this is not the clarifying language, what is the clarifying language that both makes it easy for you to implement this and makes it clear for the museums that are involved in this, and it's not just one, that what they are doing is within their mission and feeds their mission in an appropriate way? So I guess I would challenge you, if this isn't the clarifying language, bring me the clarifying language and we'll get busy on it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think that's a very reasonable request, and I think it would be appropriate for the proponents of the bill and for the assessors and the counties to get together and see if they can agree on something that might work, recognizing that we only have a very short window now to do anything on this issue.
Yeah. And while I'm wound...
Please go ahead. Yeah, while you're on, maybe let's keep going.
I think this language is very clear. To sell or hold out for sale goods related to the display or educational purposes of the museum or goods and services providing refreshment to the public while visiting the museum, unless the real property or personal property is used in such sales as leased for a nonprofit entity. I think that's pretty clear language. I've read a lot of statute that wasn't that clear. So I think... we're trying to get at this, and if this isn't going to get us there, how are we going to protect all of these real treasures for our economy from spending an awful lot of time with the tax assessors looking, you know, right down to who's standing serving me coffee in the aquarium, and whether my kid can go in there and buy this crazy crab hat that has nothing to do with real crab, but it looks darling. I can show you pictures.
Yeah, maybe he needs a spruce goose hat.
Well, I mean, it's just so quote cute, you can't stand it.
Representative Bailey, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don't actually have a question, just a comment.
Please.
If you'll indulge one. it does seem to me that this is fairly complex, and especially for a short session, in the sense that I think we are trying to distinguish, if I might be crude, where the lines are between, say, a museum and an amusement park. And if we don't have a Six Flags in Oregon, if we did have a Six Flags in Oregon and they had an area that was devoted to the history of the roller coaster, you know, Where do we draw those distinctions and those lines about what is ancillary to the mission and what is the core mission? And I wonder if that's part of the heart of what we're trying to get at here in something that is definitely a gray area at times.
Thank you. Other questions or comments?
Representative?
Yes, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. For those at the dais right now, I wonder if you could respond to the assertion that in all the other or as many as we could know, museums in the state, cafes, gift shops have not been assessed. Now, most cafes and gift shops that I've been in do have some commercial products in them sold by some for-profit entities, whether or not it's a local Oregon wine or local trinkets, local toys, things like that. So I don't find that dispositive either, that there may be for-profit element to some of this, because frankly, all that profit is going to support the institution. But with regard to the specific question, I wonder if you could respond to that.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Davis, I think you heard this morning that generally throughout Oregon, all of these types of museums and scientific museums are exempt. And in most cases, that I can think of, if they have a small area to provide these types of services, whether it be food and beverages or a small gift shop, whether it's in a hospital and you have a florist shop, these are very de minimis activities that I don't think anyone would raise a question about whether they rise to a level where taxation needs to be a consideration. But I also very much appreciate Representative Bailey's comments, because those are the kinds of difficult things that we deal with when we get to a point where some of the uses that the property is being put to, we have to make a determination about whether they rise to a level that, you know, may be appropriate for taxation to be a consideration. So that would be the answer that I would give.
And just to follow
please
up.
Please go ahead.
Yeah, the follow-up is that apparently then this is an issue of first impression where that level has apparently been reached, because I haven't seen any other assertions that that level has been reached by any other Oregon museums.
I think that's why we're saying that, or Chair Barnett, Representative David, I think that's why we're saying that this is a question of fact in this case, that, a concern that the assessors have is the bill is actually being considered in anticipation of some ongoing appeal processes that may in and of themselves clarify some of this question.
Thank you. It occurs to me, and I'll just say it bluntly, because I think that's what both of these last couple of comments and questions have alluded to. The courts are set up specifically to deal with fact-based questions, and then to write distinctions based on those fact-based questions and their interpretation of the statute as it exists. They're peculiarly good at that. They have rules of evidence. They take testimony and receive documents to prove one thing or another about the facts of a situation. The legislature is an extremely blunt instrument when it comes to dealing with those same kinds of issues. And, I mean, unless something new comes in the next couple of days, my inclination is to let the court process finish and then figure out if we need to make some change in the statute based on their results. Courts also do things that are crazy sometimes, but usually, if we leave them alone and let them do their work, they can refine the statute that in ways that would be very difficult for us to do.
Chair Barnard, just a short comment. I appreciate your comments, and I just wanted to take a quick opportunity to say that I don't want to leave this committee of Vice Chair Berger or your with the impression that you are muddying the water in any way. I really appreciate your thoughtful discussion of this particular bill, and we agree with the importance of having things that are clearly understood for everyone.
Thank you, and I'm maybe was very strong in my words.
Thank you. Appreciate it very much. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard this morning on House Bill 4106? Mr. Phillips. Should have expected the department might want to weigh in. And you can see why I wanted to start exactly at 8 o'clock. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. I hadn't intended to speak, but I felt might be helpful. A couple of comments. On the proponent's testimony, there was a statement that this is a well-understood exemption, and I take issue with that. I think we've had a lot of litigation in this area, particularly 307-130 has been well-litigated, and there's a lot more work to do. It takes up a lot of assessor time. The statement by Mr. Roman was that this is a major issue, and I guess I think that's an understatement. So I almost disagree with that, too, because I think he understates the seriousness of it. You might imagine, under this statute, that someone who has 20 acres, a caged-in area, and 20 cats would apply for the charitable exemption and the scientific exemption. There's almost no one who hasn't thought, well, I'm sure there's additional scenarios out there, but you would not believe the range of... Catland is a company that was established to create an exemption under 307-130 to get an exemption here under the charitable and the scientific, and it relieves government of having to, you know, spread cat diseases. So there are arguments being made by just about everybody, including the religious exemption, you know, and establishing churches in the home. And all of that can be very good, and there's some very good things being done out there, but it's very hard for assessors to sort this out. So hard that this go-around for the 15 legislation, I submitted a concept for the agency and the governor to support that would say that under 307-130, the only criteria is that you be a 501c3 corporation, nonprofit. That will go down in flames, and no one will support that. But it would open it up. It'd be a huge revenue impact, but it would give us one objective criteria, because we just don't have anything now. And so we have assessors out there trying to figure out what's incidental, what's primary use, what's exclusive use, and it's very confusing. And so that's why I want to say that it was very good for me yesterday to hear you say that this is on your 15 agenda when we discussed the nonprofit corporation bill yesterday that also deals with the same statute. So thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Thank you very much. I have questions for Mr. Phillips? Thank you. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4106. Let me inquire of the committee. Does anybody have to leave early today? No? Okay. We'll open the public...
No snow yet.
Yeah, we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 4138.
Close.
That's bad, though.
Chris?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4138 relates to an issue that you heard during the legislative days in January. This would modify the method of corporate apportionment of business income for interstate broadcasters. It changes the basis of apportionment from an audience base to receipts from business, the state of domicile for the customers of the interstate broadcasters. And it would apply to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2014. And in OLIS, you also have a dash one. As drafted, there's no sunset date on the bill. There is a dash one amendment that puts a six-year sunset date on the bill.
Oh, you're going to, yes, please. Representative Vega Peterson is going to testify.
Hi. Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Vega Peterson. I'm the representative of House District 47, which is the part of the city of Portland that's east of I-205. There are other people who are going to be testifying as to the details of the bill, but just as a reminder, House Bill 4138 is the bill that we had a presentation on during legislative days, as well as that I talked about when we were presenting our bills, that has to do with the modernization of the system of how state apportionment is done for the broadcasting industry. And this is really focusing on the change of technology and what's changed in the industry. When this method was first used, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, when there were three network broadcasting stations, and the only medium that was used in order to get this content, to get this media, was through watching it through your television. Now, that has changed significantly. I think all of us have our computers or our iPads or whatever it is, where we can look at movies and we can look at TV, and we might be doing that in Oregon, we might be doing that somewhere else. We might be using it on multiple reasons. So this has changed in many ways. We also have different people, not just network broadcasters, but several different companies now that are providing content. And so this is an attempt to modernize that, the way that we're looking at apportioning revenue for states, so that it truly reflects what the technology is doing today. There's been a lot of work done between Legislative Revenue Office, between the Department of Revenue, to talk about how we're going to actually make this change and what impact that would be. I believe that there is work being done right now in a Dash 2 amendment that will look at the reporting of this, and there'll be more details given about that. But if you have any questions, that's all I have.
Thank you, Representative Berger.
Yeah, no particular question. This is a staff. Yeah, I was just looking at the amendment, and it's a little more complicated than there's some definitional changes in the amendment along with the timing changes. And I wondered if it would be possible. This is a very complicated bill and not an area that I understand, and I just wondered if amendments could be combined if we're getting more so that we can read and don't have to try and struggle through the engrossing.
If I may, the amendment, it's I think the Ledge Council refers to this as a double amendment, where all of the, if you had the bill and the amendment, the new language and the deleted language in the bill are reversed in the amendment.
Okay.
And the effective date the effective date of the bill is January 1, 2014, and then the effective date of the amendment, speaking a little bit loosely, would be January 1, 2020. So basically, existing law comes back into place for tax year 2020.
Okay.
So it is a lot more than a simple one-line amendment that says this sunsets on January 1, 2020.
This, Mr. Chair, is one of the problems with our electronic system. Is I'm used to taking an amendment and taking the bill and comparing them, and you can't electronically. That you just got to print them and look. So all any right. Help you can give in this. would help us.
The key language appears to be on line 27, page 2 of the amendment, which says in line 11, delete the period and insert comma, and before January 1, 2020. So that's the that's the end date.
But there's a whole bunch of new language in there that that's actually is reversal.
It's a restoration of the old language.
Exactly. And that's why I'm just saying this is
a that's the way you do a sunset in a situation like this.
It's a little tricky.
Yeah. I think it's wonderful to point that out so that people are not confused about this amendment that looks a lot more complicated, but all it really does is put back the language as it exists now as of January 1, 2020.
All right.
Yes. Other questions for Senator Baker Peterson, and then we'll go on to the people who came a long way to be heard today. Thank you. We have four people signed up. Angela Mealy, Mike Costco, Scott Berry, and Ellen Miller. And please come up in whatever order makes sense to you. A slow-moving local lobbyist for a change.
That's right. Mr. Chair, good morning. My name is Scott Berry here on behalf of the Motion Picture Association of America. And as you know, in the motion picture industry, they say break a leg. I didn't know that they weren't serious about that. So here I am on my fancy crutches. Today we have House Bill 4138 in front of you. Again, as mentioned by Representative Vega Peterson, this is a concept that we talked about in November during legislative days. With me then was Brian O'Leary from NBC. Today I have Angela Mealy from the Motion Picture Association of America to my right, and to her right, Michael Costco from CBS. So I will turn it over to them, and hopefully we can answer any questions you might have.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Barnhart and members of the committee. My name is Angela Mealy. I'm with the Motion Picture Association of America. Some of you may
welcome
know
to Oregon.
Thank you very much. A lot less snow here than the East Coast. So.
Yeah.
But more than we're used
not
to.
Yet.
Wait 12 hours.
Wait a couple
of wait a couple.
I'm here on behalf of our members, the seven major motion picture producers and distributors of motion picture and television programs, as well as broadcasters. We represent Disney, Sony, Warner Brothers, Paramount, Fox, NBC Universal. Mike Costco, who's here from CBS Corporation, we're here to testify in support of House Bill 4138. As it was said before, this is has already been discussed in the legislative days, but what we're looking to do is get some clarity to actually modernization to sourcing for broadcasters' revenues. With technology changing, with the speed of light, I think we're seeing, we don't really know where our audience is. They're no longer sitting in a living room in front of, you know, the television set. So what we're trying to do is apportion those revenues directly to our customers, who we get revenue from, our direct customers, not an audience method for people sitting in the living room. Our direct customers, we have two streams of revenue. They're either licensing content, or we get revenues from advertisers like Nike. We can always identify where our customers are. We don't really know where our audience is because they could be watching on Google Glasses or, you know, tablets and all over the country. So we no longer have that. They're so mobile. So we want to have some certainty as to where our customers are. Mike's going to go into the details of that, but what I want to make clear is this does not impact any other industry. It's really only for these limited broadcasters. I know the broadcasters are going to come up and testify. We've been working with them as well. Basically, this apportionment formula is not something brand new. We've been looking, we've done this in four other states around the country, so it's not a new concept. It is a modernization concept as technology changes, so we're trying to provide certainty and a method that is easy to audit for Department of Revenue and administer for our company. So thank you, and be happy to answer questions once the testimony is finished.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Good morning, Chairman Barnhart and members of the Revenue Committee. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak today. I'm here to testify in support of Bill.
And if you would state your name for the record,
that
would be helpful.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's Michael Costco. I'm Vice President of State and Local Tax Operations for CBS Corporation.
Thank you.
You're welcome. The proposed amendment modernizes the method by which we apportion our earnings to Oregon. 25-plus years ago, the statute that was enacted was based upon audience share. The amendment applies to existing commercial domicile to this industry and provides more certainty in defining the revenue we're going to be sourcing to the state. The method most accurately reflects a broadcaster's Oregon sales because it represents the location of where the customer's management makes the decisions to enter into advertising or licensing contracts with the media companies. This bill will not affect Oregon customers' tax liability. It's just a means of us sourcing revenue for the media companies to this state. I think it's important to spend a minute looking at the chart that we have provided, which I think you folks have, and looking back and seeing as it gets more complicated. In the past, there was the major three networks that provided its content generally over satellite directly to the customer through rabbit ears or antenna on rooftops. The changes, the first page shows the early phases who earned this money and revenue, like CBS, NBC, or ABC, earned their money from companies like Nike or Precision Cast Parts. The method of taxation from 25 years ago is based on viewing audiences with a simple proxy for us being taxed within the state of Oregon. We are looking to have our tax be reflective of how our revenue is generated by our customers. Simply, if we have customers within Oregon, then our networks as taxpayers report our income based on how much we are paid by Oregon customers like Nike and other advertisers, or licensing of local stations for syndicated programming, reruns, midday programming, such as talk shows. We merely want to be taxed like the rest of the business community is taxed, which is how much did our customers pay us? That is what gets attributed to the numerator of our Oregon income tax apportionment formula. In slide two, you'll see an example of CBS's and the other interstate broadcasters' business models. And as you can see, our customers are those who pay us licensing programming revenue or buy advertising time. The viewers are our customer's customer. Moreover, no one knows where any particular viewer is watching the programming at any particular point in time. I can watch all of my shows on my iPad here in Salem. Am I a New York viewer or am I an Oregon viewer? No one is sitting at home, or elsewhere for that matter, sends a check directly to CBS for watching these programs. We continue to strive to make consumers have access anytime, anywhere, and by any means. With the proliferation of access to this content, we never know where the viewer is. We will always know where our customer is. That is an easy way to audit and administer by the state and is not able to be manipulated by us. That's the decision where to commercially locate is our customer's decision. A good analogy would be the manufacture of computer components being sent to Apple to be included in an iPad or a laptop computer. The destination of the computer components would be Apple, not the individual who bought the computer. Instead of selling them a computer, we are selling them content, and they are bundling it for Amazon Prime or Netflix to their customers and then selling it. I'll take any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Vance, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming by my office this morning and trying to help me understand this interesting situation. So if we had no companies domiciled in Oregon making these decisions, how much would Oregon be paid?
Like Nike, if Nike was not a major advertiser,
right,
it would be significantly less.
Oh, I said I
don't know what the numbers are. It would be probably less. Based on commercial domicile, it would be less. If we were to move from a current audience method to commercial domicile, it would probably go down.
Please, yeah.
Just a clarification as well is this will capture not just specifically advertisers who are advertising on our networks, but also local television stations, part of our affiliates or other licensees of our content within the state that we might contract directly with. So in our case, the local CBS affiliate is getting a feed of programming from CBS. And, you know, to the extent they're contracting directly with us for that feed, that would be sourced to the numerator as well.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, please.
So when I was looking at the summary here, I understand your need for certainty, but I was trying to figure out how the concept in some way was linked to your activity in this state. And I couldn't put those two together. there's activity going on through broadcasting out to people in the state. They're listening. Your people are paying, let's say, GM from Indiana or wherever it is, and that money comes to you someplace, and you then use it to send your information out and advertising from GM. But we know that activity is occurring here, but because GM's not here, it wouldn't be taken into account in determining what you would pay as tax. Am I right so far?
I'm actually not understanding totally the question. You're saying that the money from through the chair from GM?
Your proposal is that your apportionment will be based upon the commercial domicile of those who buy advertising from you. Is that much correct?
Commercial, yes, but that pay us for advertising. Yeah.
Correct. That buy advertising from you.
Yeah.
And so GM is not in this state. Excuse me,
correct.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, please go ahead. Yeah, this requires a little bit of a dialogue, so please go ahead.
Thank you. Okay, so General Motors not domiciled here. General Motors would not be taken into account in determining the amount that you would pay the state of Oregon as tax.
Correct.
Is that much correct?
Yes. Yes.
So I am saying if we don't have any companies domiciled in the state of Oregon, yet you're here doing business, would you pay zero tax into Oregon?
It wouldn't be zero tax, but in terms of commercial domicile, through the chair, in terms of commercial domicile, yes, I guess in theory, if no advertisers were located, but we still have licensing, programming, and things of that nature that we do. So there are really two streams of revenue. It's not solely advertising. It's licensing and advertising. So I would imagine you're always going to want to have your local stations would want to have midday programming that they receive licensing revenues, and they would still be coming to Oregon.
As far as the way the income tax return works as well, the income earned from advertising from GM or Coca-Cola or any of the other large advertisers go into the income statement of the overall entity, and whether or not that entity, whether it's ABC, NBC, Viacom, or the other members, that income is part of the pot that's getting allocated to the state. The focus we have on is the ratio of presence within the state. So the income for GM would be in, let's pick a number of $100 million.
Okay.
We're focused on the percentage of what's going to be allocated. So the income is still within the overall income that's being allocated to the state. That you would be getting a piece of that, but it's just not part of the formula in the ratio.
Mr. Chair, thank you for your indulgence. Can you share with us, is there some percentage you could give us of the amount you just said we would still be able to tax us compared to that, which would, again, continue with my hypothetical. We don't have any of these companies. Fortunately, we have Nike here and other others. But if we didn't, would we – I want a percentage. I don't want to have – we already asked you – you've already run the numbers. We seem to come out a bit ahead as things currently are. But that we do have some folks domiciled here, like Nike.
Correct. So. I wouldn't be able to give you a specific percentage of how much of the revenue for each of our other members would be taxable of the specific GM relationship. But from the numbers that we have put together, the percentage of, due to this clarification, moving from an audience factor to a commercial domicile factor is going up. So the clarification is adding approximately $900,000 of tax revenue to the state of Oregon, and we would assume that those ratios and disparity would stay fairly constant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Vega Peterson, and then Representative Conger.
Thank you, Chair. So one of the things I understand my colleagues' questions, because when we were first talking about this, I had similar things, and I think that. We've been talking a lot about Nike and discussion of this bill and, using them as the example because I think that's the most well-known corporation that we have. But also, when you watch advertising, you have a lot of different ways of doing that. And so, just think of all the things you see for the local car dealerships and commercials and other smaller businesses but that are also located in the state that would be considered under this law too. And I just wanted to have you state for the record that those would also be included in this, and so it's not necessarily just we're looking at, you know, one big fish that if they leave, then we're never going to be able to apportion taxes,
yes,
you know, on this industry.
Yeah, through the chair, that's exactly right. And you're always going to get advertising dollars, and there we're going to be, you know, taxpayers, they're going to be providing those tax dollars, those revenues for advertising to the locals, because all of those local advertising revenues are going to be going to the state, and that's not going to change. And the local broadcasters who have sole situs in Oregon are not going to be affected by this, because it's real. We're only talking about multi-state broadcasters. We're not talking, it will not impact the local broadcasters that are domiciled here in Oregon.
The to your point, especially the smaller local car washes or restaurants and whatnot, they might push their advertisements more through a radio medium than a television medium on a broad-based network, and those would be picked up in the numerator of the radio entities, which would be members of the overall combined return for each one of these media conglomerates.
So when a doctor advertises on the evening news in Eugene, presumably that's not that advertising revenue is not affected by this bill.
No,
because the revenue
it's intrastate, not apportionable.
Well, it depends on who they're paying that advertising for. A local broadcaster, no, that's not going to change.
Right. Thank you.
A locally owned, not a group owned station. Sometimes a group owned.
Right, because they would apportion their revenue to the various states that they work in.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, great. Representative Conger, please.
So I had two questions. First, I'm wondering, Scott, is there no lengths that you won't go to? I'm in here, limp in here for sympathy. I hope you two know how. I mean, he's willing to break his leg for you. That's pretty impressive.
It wasn't a compound fracture.
Oh, good. Okay, it'll heal quick. So when we say domiciled, that means where the companies are incorporated, right? Is that how we determine domicile?
We're the headquarters. Yes, through the chair. It's in the existing statute. Is a commercial domicile is already established in statute, so it is where they're headquartered.
Okay. So
the incorporation, to your point, could be different. They could be incorporated in Arizona or Delaware. It's where the HQ is, where the management decisions are made, where the SEC reports are filed under a 10-K. Fortune 500 does a pretty detailed report of the commercial domicile for the top 1,000 companies, and then we do our diligence of where the other ones are, as well as understanding the relationships through our sales folks of where, you know, they're entering into these contracts and where the companies are located.
So for a smaller company, For a smaller company, let's set aside the Fortune 1000, and let's say it's not a public company, so they don't have a 10-K. How do you determine where their headquarters would be?
We've worked pretty closely with our sales team on where the companies are located with their management, where the contracts are entered into. They're coming into the jurisdiction, making the contracts. And there's a national sales force within most of the companies, and there's a local sales force within most of the companies. And we've also erred on the conservative side as far as, using the local sales force revenue generation to the jurisdiction where they're operating.
So, if I may go on,
yes,
so typically the sales would be made to a corporate headquarters. Okay. So, if I think I get the general concept that you're trying to build out in statute here, which is that you're taxed based on the income that comes from your customer, and the way that you identify where that income comes from is just the headquarters, which is somewhat arbitrary in a sense, but at least it's clear and simple.
And not particularly controllable from our point of view. I mean, we're not making decisions of where they commercially domicile.
So I get the certainty. I don't know. I think I'm echoing the comments, actually, that Representative Bentz already made, which is, in some ways, the way that we're looking at it now, and I understand we don't have a precise measure to figure out what the audience share would be, But it almost makes more sense because it's like, you know, you're selling, it's like being a retailer and selling a product in Oregon. That's a little easier to track, I think, but it's the same concept. So you're selling into this audience. I'm not making a perfect analogy, but, you know, the difference in the view, I guess, is who your customer is, right? To you, it's the company that you're selling to. But in some sense, the customer is also the audience. I find this a little bit confusing, and also maybe a little bit disturbing because I can only think of one or two large companies that have a significant advertising budget in the state of Oregon. I don't know, for a larger state maybe, or a state with more corporate headquarters, they'd be wise to shift to this. I'm not 100% sure we would be.
I mean, it's not only advertising. There are two streams of revenue. It's both advertising and licensing revenue and programming that are coming into the state. So it's not only advertising. And in terms of the liability, we had run the calculations, and there was a slight uptick in that. But one of the things that, in terms of how we decide on advertising revenues and how much we'll charge, is really not based on a state-by-state basis. We will tell an advertiser, like Nike or whomever, we'll say, we're going to guarantee you an audience of whatever the percentage over a certain time period. It's not just we're going to guarantee you, 500,000 viewers in Oregon. It's going to be, we're going to say that the audience we're going for is this certain audience, but it's nationwide. So when we sell advertising, we're not actually just selling advertising to that one state. So that's really just to give you an understanding of the way advertising is. But again, it's not just advertising dollars. It's also the licensing revenue and programming that are, always coming in.
One just quick follow-up on that. Under the current system, the licensing revenue then is just included in the calculation for apportionment, or is it tracked specifically to the state?
Under the current scenario, the licensing revenue would be included just as advertising would, based upon a viewing audience ratio overall over U.S. total households. With Oregon viewers as the numerator. One of the other points that had been brought out in some prior discussions as well is within the overall combined return, under the audience scenario, we are applying revenue by an audience factor for the companies, and there could be 200 companies in these returns, but only to the companies that have a physical presence within the state. Under the commercial domicile, there'd be licensing entities or other entities that do not have a physical presence in the state, and to the extent we're getting either licensing revenue or advertising revenue, whether it's through a TV screen or online, there's CBS Online that provides content that has banner ads and different things, we would be sourcing that, advertising revenue or licensing revenue to the state, to the extent that that's where the customer is within Oregon. So that's part of the interplay with the difference in ratios between the advertising scenario and the commercial domicile scenario. The overall income generally stays the same. It's just the ratio is, and the ratio has increased, for the majority of our members. One has gone down slightly compared to the two, but the increase for the other members outweighs the decrease, and the decrease is minor.
Representative Davis?
Thank you, Chair, and thanks very much for your testimony. My difficulty is that we're talking in general terms, and then you're making reference to some specific ratios. Are you going to share those with the committee or submit those for testimony is one question. But to clarify what those numbers may be, if I'm understanding in very crude terms, and I know the ratios are slightly different, but in terms of households and individuals in the United States, call it about 300 million, in Oregon about 4 million. So the current ratio, roughly, I know the numbers are different, is about 4 million as the numerator. the denominator being about 300 million, although I know it's based on households and not on individuals. What's surprising to me is you're saying that that ratio is actually going to increase, and I think maybe some of the pushback you're feeling is you've been using terms like Nike, and we only know of Nike and Precision Cast Parts as the only two Fortune 500 companies in Oregon. Precision probably doesn't do much licensing, or maybe they do, I'm hearing. So I'm very interested to see the data that shows that ratio increasing, because on a first blush, when I first heard this bill in the interim, I thought, well, it's going to go down to about zero. So it's surprising that that is increasing.
Through the chair, can I respond? One of the things that with audience now is with getting back to Nike, part of that question is their portion now is that proportion that you said that they're paying
right.
under audience.
Right.
And what they will be paying under commercial domicile, since they are commercially domiciled here, 100% of those revenues that they will be paying to right. the networks for interstate broadcasters, 100% of those revenues come here. And when you realize how much advertising Nike does nationwide, it's pretty simple.
Through all the different media.
Yes, yes.
But, yes, we have shared those data with the revenue department.
Are those going to be posted, that data, or shared?
Chris and I were just having a conversation about trade secrets and confidentiality issues. And my suspicion is that, Representative Davis, however much you and I might like to have that information, we're not going to get it.
Even though it's already been shared with the legislative revenue office?
Legislative revenue and the department have confidentiality agreements in place that allow them to view confidential tax data without sharing it directly with the committee.
Thank you.
They can give us advice based on the data, but they don't share the data with us. And that's the only way you can operate in situations where individual taxpayer data may be important as part of the analysis by the office. I didn't know that either until am I describing it fairly accurately? I am. Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? I have one. I think I know the answer, but I want to make sure it's on the record. Other states are moving to this method, and you're requesting still other states to do it. This is not a request you're making solely and specifically to the state of Oregon.
Correct. Correct.
Did we put on the record the states that did?
Yeah. Previously adopted in Michigan, Illinois, North Carolina, and Florida. And we are seeking this now in Iowa as well, which is an audience state, and we're looking to move that to a market commercial domicile as well.
Are there other audience states?
And Indiana.
Are there other audience states?
Oh, yes. There are other audience states. Yes.
Some of them
there have not been any audience states that have been adopted since 2002. All of the states, I mean, that was really kind of, they have, it that gets into a whole other story about cost of performance, but basically there are, I don't know the number, probably 15, 20 audience states, but they're, it's a different calculation for broadcasters. It's based on cost of performance, which is basically where the predominance of your costs are based on to produce that content. So as states are moving now, what states, when they had this cost of performance methodology before, it was a origin-based tax. And now what states are looking to do is increase, and they're saying a market, and they want to go to where the market is of those businesses. So as states move to this market approach, this is what we're saying. Well, when you had an origin-based tax, that worked well for us. But now as you move to a market-based tax and you apply an audience factor, that's when it really gets, it misrepresents our business activity in those states. So what we're trying to do is in those states that when they're moving to market, we're saying, okay, our market really are those people with whom we have privity of contract and we have those direct contractual relationships, because we no longer know, you know, before with cost of performance, it was easy. We knew where those costs were incurred. But now as we go to a destination-based tax, it's a lot easier to do it based on who our direct customers are.
Thank you. I think you've alluded to this, but I want to make sure I understand. What's in it for you to pay us $900,000 more?
Well, it's certainty.
Generally certainty.
And the reserves, I don't know
and
the reserves.
And to be honest, I think fairness as well. I mean, the more you move away from people watching in their living room on the television screens, you know, folks that have a little gray hair like myself still sit and watch the TV, you know, the football games and the content shows, you know, either on the screen or through DVR. The younger generation are watching almost all of their content on television screens or iPads or phones. And that percentage of our business continues to get larger. And, you know, possibly within a decade, I wouldn't think the TV screen's going away, but it's easier for us to say we know where our customers are. We don't necessarily know where the content's being watched and by whom.
Thank you, Representative Berger.
Yes, sir. I'm kind of persuaded, and I'd like to take that one more step, which is it would also be easier for our tax compliant people to audit that market rather than who's watching too. Mm-hmm. So it's easier for you, but it's also easier for us to know what is owed and the certainty there,
audit,
which is equally or maybe more important to us.
Right. That's a very good point. Anything else for this panel? We have one other witness scheduled, and that's Ellen Miller.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Oh, there she is.
Kick him on his way by.
Yeah.
Chair, I would like to note that Scott brought his fancy crutches for today.
These are my teak dress crutches.
Oh, yes. Yes. And we'll hear the story about your grape stomping activities later.
Just the 1 foot.
Just the 1 foot. Yes, ma'am. Please.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart. Vice Chair Berger, Ann Bailey, members of the committee. My name is Ellen Miller, and I'm here to represent the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. Thank you for allowing us to speak this morning on this legislation. I'm here just to show the Oregon Association of Broadcasters' support for this legislation. We wanted to thank the Motion Picture Association for working with us and for assuring our in-state broadcasters and members that they will not have any impact of this legislation. While this legislation will provide tax certainty for our few multi-state broadcasters. I'm happy to answer any questions, but I just wanted to, for the record, show our support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. The other issue that's come up, committee, on this proposal has to do with how we figure out how it actually worked. We're considering an amendment that puts a time frame around this thing, and in order to have any idea how it worked, we need to be able to say, well, this is what actually happened and this is how it compared to what we used to do. So I'm very interested in learning what method approach we're going to use to track this. I don't know whether that's a statement from Chris or whether it's a statement from the department, but I understand that there are issues around how you track this kind of revenue, and I'd be very interested in knowing how you're planning to solve that problem. And I think the committee needs to know that too. I don't know whether that's Chris or the department.
Mr. Chair, I guess to that point, we have been thinking about ways to do that, and I think Representative Vega Peterson alluded to this, the concept of an amendment that would require reporting by LRO and or the Department of Revenue in some format. To look at after a couple of years, there would be a sunset on the policy of January 1, 2020. So in year 2018 or so, after there have been a few years of filing under this method, we would be, because LRO has access to information, we could work with the department and try to come up with exactly how the policy has been implemented and if it conformed to the committee's expectations. There are a number of issues around confidentiality issues that we would need to tread lightly. But we could put together a report and some information to say, well, it roughly did meet the committee's expectation or didn't. And we're kind of working through the concepts on how detailed that amendment would be. As with most reporting requirements, if it's a general reporting requirement, it gives more flexibility as we discover information to incorporate, as opposed to a more detailed requirement which may leave out some pieces.
Okay. All right. So, Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I really do find this very interesting, and I do appreciate staff's focus on the need to look back and see how it works. The way I now am coming to understand it, it would appear that if Nike and Intel and others that picked up and left, this would be a bad bet. Movement to the device for certain purposes makes sense for many reasons, but moving away from the activities that are actually going on that would seem to be the more correct measure of that which we should tax people for, and over to this other device, it seems odd, and I'm not saying that it's wrong. It just seems odd. But going back to Representative Conger's remarks, this works in some states and not in others. Maybe we're one of them for a while. I hope.
we would certainly like to encourage more very, very large businesses to settle here, hire Oregonians, and pay Oregon income taxes, wouldn't we?
Certainly on the eastern side of the state.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. In Ontario especially.
Exactly.
Yes. Yes. Representative Rebecca Peterson, please.
Thank you, Chair. So for two things, to Representative Ben's comments, I think we've done what we can as a body to ensure that Nike and Intel will be here for a long time. So we have that.
Yeah, we have.
And second, as far as the reporting goes, my understanding is that the change from the Department of Revenue, there's not actually a big change in from there how they would be able to get this. In fact, in some ways, it's actually more simple for them to use this method. And it's really what we're working out is the reporting requirement so that LRO has a way to get that information so that we, this committee, would be able to look back into the future to make sure, or look back to make sure that this change actually had the effect that we wanted to. And to that effect, you know, here it's a small plus in this state, but again, it's more of a modernizing of this method that we're using, and we're not looking for big gains or big losses here. It's just making sure that we can track what actually happened and that it was that it didn't have that much effect.
Great, thank you. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4138. Colleagues, I would like to go to work sessions now. I think we're all here. So let's open a work session on House Bill 4003. Chris, do you want to bring us up to date on that one?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is the Reconnect bill that you heard yesterday. There is no revenue impact and there is no fiscal impact. So both those statements are no impact statements.
There was no amendments.
And there were no amendments.
No amendments, and no said amendments. We heard it yesterday. This is the Reconnect bill that moves a bunch of dates, but probably doesn't have any real effect because of Congress being as active and as it was last year.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. I had another conversation with the Ledge Council, and there were maybe seven or eight bills that touched the they didn't change the IRC, mm-hmm. and didn't really touch the so therefore didn't really flow through to the personal income tax. I think the example that came to their mind first was an excise tax on vaccines or something, but would have no impact on Oregon.
Okay, and so all we do is this bill is really the increase the comfort of the accountancy bill.
Yes, and it provides a certainty that when the CPA or tax auditor looks up the date, it is the most recent date.
Okay,
there's no question about what happened in 2013 that we didn't tie to.
All right, Representative Berger.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4003 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves House Bill 4003 to the floor with a do pass recommendation and discussion. Any objection to the motion? No objection. The motion is carried. Who'd like to carry this bill? I mean, Representative Benz. You'll get to explain the complexity of this important bill.
Happy to do so.
Thank you. Representative Benz will carry, and with that, we'll close the work session. on House Bill 4003. I'm informed that 4039 is not ready to work. There's some additional issues that need to be addressed, so we'll move to our final public hearing, and open a public hearing on House Bill 4005. And who's on? Is that yours, too? Okay, please, go ahead. Well, it is yours, of course. Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is a bill, you saw a version of it, or conceptual last session. It creates a manufacturing investment tax credit. It would be a refundable income tax and corporate excise tax credit for capital investments of at least $2.5 million. It's basically a replacement investment tax credit for the old MANI, or a revision of the MANI, depending on how one wants to look at it. At a very high level, that's it. There's a lot of detail about requirements for certification by the Oregon Business Development Department. It limits the potential total tax credits to $50 million per biennium and limits certifications to be issued between July 1, 2014 and December 31st, 2017. And it also requires Business Oregon to report to the legislature each odd number year on the utilization of the tax credit.
Very good. Thank you. I've just received word that House Bill 4039, which was scheduled for work session today, it will be ready tomorrow, so we'll carry over that work session. So you'd be aware that that'll be posted for tomorrow as well. We have two witnesses who've asked to be heard on 4005, Jody Weiser and Marcia Kelly. Could you come forward, please?
For the record, Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. In the absence of the department in the room, is it the assumption this bill is just going to die?
I wouldn't schedule a hearing if I was certain the bill was going to die.
It just seems odd that there's no advocates in the room. When I met with Paul Grove a couple of weeks ago, he said that they understood that this bill was not ready to move, that it had lots of problems, and they had not worked on it at all since the end of last session. And instead, they would like to restart the expired Betsy Manufacturing Tax Credit. It expired on December 31st of 2013, and so this would be a restart of that tax credit with
Mr.
the...
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Kelser, please.
I appreciate that conversation. It always just makes me nervous when someone is sharing the position of other right. folks, so maybe we could wait for them to represent their...
Well, that's position. Why I was surprised they're not here.
Well, I should be a little bit less, a little bit more ingenuous, I guess, and acknowledge that it's line two of the bill that is of particular interest to me.
And I was hopeful that that the relating clause was valuable. Because
that is line two of the bill.
Okay, I was guessing that, but I wasn't sure. Because in reviewing...
But so if you have short remarks on the substance of the bill itself, we would be pleased to hear them.
Right, well, on the substance of the bill, I don't need to make comments except that it's pretty weak bill. It's for all kind of manufacturing without so much as a definition of manufacturing, though we have that manufacturing definitions in our law. And it calls a capital expense things that would have always been called operating expenses in the past, like the operating funds, the salaries that paid and the training expenses of the first year are defined as part of capital expenses. So obviously the bill itself is pretty weak. And we wanted to point out that this would not be, if you did an extension, it wouldn't be an extension of a bill. The bill is dead. And so it would be re-upping the bill. And we're hopeful that you might use this as a way to say it's time to actually look at what we're doing with economic development subsidies. Because of the greater transparency we have now, we've seen things like in the city of Hillsboro, with the enterprise zones, we've paid as little as $231 a year a job for 5 years and as much as $17,500 a year for a job. And that's quite a range and it's pretty unrelated to what the benefit might be for the community. And And it would be good to have real evaluation where we looked at a program like the business retention program, which the head of the department says is the best tool he has and is far less expensive than many of the things we're doing, particularly if we do something like this manufacturing bill, which would cost as much as $200,000 per job.
I think your testimony is that this, if I understand it correctly, trying to make what you just said germane, that this bill is really beside the topic of what we need to be analyzing.
We need to analyze, not act. Yes.
Right. Thank you. Do you have anything else to add?
No, that's
Thank
it.
You. Please go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Berger, Vice Chair Bailey, and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the American Association of University Women. This is a bill that has great big holes in it that we think should not go forward. I will only call your attention to page 2, line 17. Prior to certification, the taxpayer will hire additional employees with a net gain of at least 5 full-time year-round employees per $1 million of tax credit allowed. How long would it take Oregon to recoup $1 million in tax credits from 5 employees? This bill really needs a lot of work.
And we'd appreciate your additional analysis at another time of the other issues that are contained in this bill. I think that the way I perceive this bill, at least, is that it's a first attempt at an industrial policy bill. And because of that, we bring it up. We vet it with the understanding that it is a first attempt. And then we'll continue to look at the issue. Are there questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We do appreciate your testimony today. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4005. Colleagues, we're finished for today. We have a very busy day tomorrow. I plan to be here at 8 o'clock. If there are traffic issues tomorrow, I mean, we'll do the best we can. I understand. I see that there's snow actually on the sidewalks over here. So I don't want anybody injuring themselves or others trying to get here on time.
I-5 has just been closed in Albany.
Please keep us informed by telephone if there are problems, and we will accommodate. I mean, we have a very limited number of days we're allowed to work, but we will do the best we can to accommodate. And it's not just members who have trouble getting here, but also witnesses. And so if you know you're going to have problems in the morning, the staff is here. You usually here about 7:30, aren't you? Even before that, so somebody will be here to answer the phone. When you know you're going to be late or are not going to be able to make it, please let the office know. And with anything else, thank you. With that, the committee's adjourned. Thank you. With that, the committee's adjourned. Okay.